This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The war in the 1980s between the Afghan fighters known as the Mujahideen and the invading Soviet army transformed the world. The Afghans won with arms and training supplied covertly by the CIA, and their victory contributed to the fall of communism. But the American backing of the Afghan jihad led to many unintended consequences, which America continues to face today in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. Charlie Wilson, the colorful, persuasive, and persistent Texas congressman who was behind the billions of dollars funneled to the CIA to support the Afghan rebels, died Wednesday after suffering a heart attack. He was 76 years old. The story of American support of the Afghan rebels was told by journalist George Kreil in his 2003 book, Charlie Wilson's War. In 2007, Hollywood made a film of the same name. Today, we'll listen back to Terry's interviews with the real Charlie Wilson and with author George Kreil, who described our country's support of the Mujahideen as the biggest and most successful CIA covert campaign in history. George Kreil died in 2006 at the age of 61 after suffering from pancreatic cancer. Charlie Wilson was an unlikely figure to back a so-called holy war. His reputation in Congress was as a seemingly corrupt, alcoholic, scandal-prone womanizer. Let's start with a scene from the movie version of Charlie Wilson's War. Tom Hanks plays the title role, and Philip Seymour Hoffman co-stars as CIA operative Gust Avrakatos. As we'll hear from George Kreil, it was Avrakatos who got Wilson to focus on a program of covert support for the Afghan rebels. In this scene, Wilson and Avrakatos are having a drink in the congressman's office. The first person to speak is Charlie Wilson.
You drink?
No, God, yeah.
Well, should we try? This sconchers are going to release sarin gas when I open it.
Well, I don't think so, but open it over there.
How'd a guy like you get into the agency?
What, you mean a street guy?
You ain't James Bond.
You ain't Thomas Jefferson, so let's call it even.
Good deal.
Since there's no other reason I should be here, let's assume it's because I'm very good at this.
A scene from Charlie Wilson's War. Later in this half hour, we'll hear Terry's interview with the real Charlie Wilson. But we'll start with George Kreil. Terry spoke with Kreil in 2003 when his book on Charlie Wilson was published.
Now, Charlie Wilson managed to get a lot of money from the CIA for arming the Mujahideen. How did he, as a congressman, manage to make that connection with the CIA?
With great difficulty. The CIA, at all costs, wanted to avoid having anything to do with him. They felt that he was a cocaine-sniffing, scandal-prone, skirt-chasing danger, you know, probably the most notorious, wildest man of Congress at the time. And their reaction when he came into their lives offering to increase their budget to fight a secret war in Afghanistan was to look with absolute horror at such an offer. They felt, with friends like that, we need no enemies. And what ensued was a knockdown, drag-out fight. But it was only possible because of the curiosities of Congress and his position on the Appropriations Committee.
How important was he on the Appropriations Committee, and how did that help him?
What you have is, with the Appropriations Committee, where the money is actually spent, when you drop it down to the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, you will have 11 people in the House responsible ultimately for deciding how much money the Pentagon gets, the NSA, the CIA, all the intelligence agencies. And Charlie Wilson was one of those 11.
No, he finally had an ally in the CIA. Who was the ally?
A most unexpected character named Gust Avrakatos. By the time that Wilson met him, he was both had a very distinguished history at the CIA as a kind of, I call him the blue-collar James Bond, but also a person who had alienated most everybody. And he was very, very distressed with what he thought bureaucratic cowardice that had come over the CIA and the domination of the agency by lawyers. And what happened in this case is that Avrakatos, who had been making his way in a very dramatic and bizarre fashion to a position in the Afghan task force, had encountered Wilson's attempt to force the CIA into a larger war. And without telling any of his superiors, he took off in a car, went down to Congress, and entered Wilson's office completely unauthorized and confronted him with the challenge that if you think you want to fight the Russians and kill the Russians more than me, you're crazy. And he did it in such a way that it made Charlie feel that maybe he might physically attack him. He's a really tough customer. And from that moment on, the two of them began to engage in a partnership and what amounts to down and dirty plotting to figure out how, with Avrakatos's information of how things happen in the CIA and what Wilson should say using his power on the Appropriations Committee, how they could put the CIA into a box where it had no choice but to accept stunning amounts of money that they didn't want to spend. Terry, can I give you a context here?
Sure.
You know, if you think back to that time when this story begins, right after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, Christmas of 1979, just about a month later, the Afghans are a lost cause. And the terrible scenes that were broadcast around the world of the Afghans beginning to flee their country and the beginnings of what came to be called a genocidal war were very evident. And there was nothing really that they could do to change the picture. They just had World War I rifles and hunting rifles and this ferocious fighting spirit and conviction. But at that moment, they had nothing really that could help them other than, as in a fairy tale, they needed a heroic figure to emerge out of somewhere and magically come to their rescue. And there was such a person, curiously. But at that moment, he was stepping into a hot tub in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace in the Fantasy Suite with two naked women with cocaine in their purses. And it is so odd to think that this is the man, Charlie Wilson, Congressman Charlie Wilson, who will get himself out of the hot tub and pull himself together in about a year and a half after this, discover the Afghans, discover this cause, and for a period of about 5 years, he will emerge as the centerpiece in the biggest and meanest and most successful CIA campaign in history and will be responsible for giving or making possible a total victory for militant Islam in the greatest jihad of modern history.
Was the CIA very interested in supporting the Afghans? I mean, you talk in your book about how this was one war in which the real enemy, the way they saw it, the real enemy, the Soviets, could actually be directly engaged. It wasn't a war with Soviet proxies. It was a war with the Soviets themselves. Was that very appealing to the CIA?
Yes and no, but mainly no, in that they didn't want to do it in the way that Wilson and Avrakatos ultimately forced them to do it.
Too risky?
Yeah, much too risky. I mean, what had happened by that year, or by that time in the early 1980s, the CIA had more or less established a pattern of conduct where they were engaged in endless war. It was almost as if it was viewed as permanent campaigns on the fringes to contain the Soviets. And the one thing they didn't want to do is to take on any kind of provocative campaigns that could escalate into some unforeseen drama. And in the case of Afghanistan and Pakistan, they had no choice but to use General Zia, the military dictator of Pakistan, President Zia, and Pakistan as the base of operations. And it was provocative because the United States, for the very first time, was supporting anti-communist guerrillas who were moving to kill Soviet soldiers. And that had never happened in the Cold War. It was the very first time that the United States actually set out to kill our enemy, to mount operations designed to kill Russians.
Were there any concerns in Congress or in the CIA or in the Reagan administration that the United States was going to be arming Islamic fundamentalists with high-tech weapons, training these warriors how to use the weapons, while knowing that a lot of the Islamic fundamentalists hated the United States? They didn't just hate the Soviets.
There was certainly a good deal of concern inside the CIA in the early years when Charlie Wilson was trying to force them to escalate this war. And one of their perfectly understandable concerns was that, you know, what happens afterward? What are the unintended consequences? Is it a good idea to get, is to make this a huge war? Would it provoke a Pakistani or an attack by the Red Army, the Russians, on Pakistan? What consequences could that have? What are we going to do with all of these Muslim fundamentalists? What kind of weapons, what kind of training is appropriate to give to them? And all of those questions were very real and part of the initial battle that the CIA waged to try to prevent this massive escalation. But the truth is, once they got into it, once they lost the battle with Charlie Wilson and the secret partner, Gustav Rakatos, helping him from within the CIA, once they lost it and the money started to flow in and the war started to escalate and the tide started to turn, the CIA became absolutely giddy and thrilled at this battle, because it was the first time that they were actually setting out to kill the enemy, to engage him in a winner-take-all battle. And no one thought that this was possible to win, but they increasingly came to think it would be. And then it happened. And for the longest time, this was viewed as the great triumph of the CIA in the last campaign of the Cold War.
George Kreil, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
George Kreil, author of the book Charlie Wilson's War, speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. Kreil died 3 years later at age 61. Coming up, a conversation with the real Charlie Wilson, who died Wednesday. This is Fresh Air. Charlie Wilson, the Texas congressman who helped end the Cold War with his persistent efforts in the 1980s to aid the Afghan rebels in their fight against the Soviets, died Wednesday of a heart attack. He was 76 years old. In the 2007 movie Charlie Wilson's War, Tom Hanks played the congressman. Julia Roberts co-starred as a conservative, fiercely anti-communist Texas socialite.
So unless I'm wrong, and that would be unusual for me, you sit at the intersection of the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA. You meet in a soundproof room underneath the Capitol, and you preside over a secret and unlimited budget for the three agencies you would need to conduct a covert war. Isn't that right?
I also have seats at the Kennedy Center.
Isn't that how you were able to double the CIA budget for black approps in Afghanistan just by saying so?
Why are you only asking me questions you already know the answers to?
Why is Congress saying one thing and doing nothing?
Well, tradition mostly.
In 2003, Terry Gross spoke with the real Charlie Wilson, who took on the Afghan rebels' cause as his own and became one of the leading figures behind their covert funding. She asked him why he felt so strongly about the Afghan cause.
I was outraged, of course, Christmas of 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan for no reason other than simple aggression. And I thought that, well, this will just be another case of 6 weeks, and they'll pacify the country and kill all the fighters, and it'll just be another satellite. But after several months, it began to dawn on me that the Afghans, without weapons, were killing Russian officers in Kabul with knives and stones and anything they could get their hands on. And then it became clear to me, and I think this is the most important single part of this war, it became clear to me that the Afghans had made a decision themselves without American or any Western participation. But they had made a decision themselves to fight till the end if they had to fight with their bare hands. And I just strongly felt that people that brave, that were that opposed to being subdued by the evil empire, if you will, that that we would be damned by history if we let them fight with their hands. And so that my interest was aroused there. And after another few months, I made a trip just to see for myself as much as I could see along the border there. I had been friendly with Pakistan before this. And when I visited the hospitals and saw the children with their feet and hands blown off by the Soviet mines that had been disguised to look like toys and that sort of thing, and I just became radicalized.
Now, at the time, you were living a lifestyle very different from the Afghan Mujahideen. I mean, you were hanging out in casinos, hot tubs, relationships with beauty pageant queens. Is there an example you can think of the most unusual coming together of cultures, your culture and their culture?
Well, let's see. There certainly wasn't an example that had anything to do with alcohol, because I didn't do that in front of them. I suppose the fact that I was single at the time, and I've been traveling to exciting and exotic places, you like to have someone to share it with. And so I suppose the fact that I wasn't married and they saw me with different Western girlfriends was a major shock to them, although they never gave any evidence of it. They didn't lift an eyebrow.
There's an expression called blowback to describe the unintended consequences of a war. What surprised you most about the blowback after the Afghan war with the Soviets?
Of course, and I take my full share of the blame, but and at the time, I didn't realize how serious it was. But the United States, once the communist government had fallen, once the Russians had left, we sort of lost interest, the United States and other Western countries. And because of that, we created a vacuum. And Afghans in a vacuum tend to fight each other for power. And there were many of them that had been radicalized on the Islamic side from their war with the godless Soviets. It was largely our responsibility, because we should have stayed there and we should have insisted that they somehow work together. We should have held out a lot of carrots and more or less forced them to work together, or at least not to go to war with one another. And I was surprised by that. The Taliban then, when they really came in and totally filled the vacuum, and many people in Afghanistan supported the Taliban that did not adhere to their religious beliefs or to their philosophy, but simply because they saw them as the first chance to have order in 15 or 18 years, to not have war, I was stunned and totally surprised. And felt very badly about it.
What went through your mind on September 11th when you heard, you know, when you found out that it was Islamic fundamentalists who were behind the attacks?
Well, I was very grievous and devastated, and somehow I knew that I felt very badly about that. I didn't feel conscience-stricken. I just felt sad that of the cruelty of the attacks and the fanaticism of the attacks, and the fact that they obviously were coming from radical Islamic people, who I still felt that we were in great debt to many of, for really driving the nail in the coffin of the evil empire. And then to see them not on our side was a tough nut for me.
Well, Charlie Wilson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Charlie Wilson, speaking with Terry Gross in 2003, the former Democratic congressman from Texas and the subject of the book and movie versions of Charlie Wilson's War, died Wednesday at age 76. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is comic, actress, and writer Carol Liefer. She started working the comedy clubs when Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, and Larry David were getting started, and they became her friends. She later wrote for the NBC series Seinfeld, and she's also had her own TV comedy specials. Her memoir, called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win, has just come out in paperback. Carol Liefer is 53 years old now. Her book is about a lot of the surprising changes she made in her life as she got older. Like, after she turned 40, she decided she wanted to have a lesbian fling. That first fling turned into a committed relationship. Liefer and her partner adopted a son a few years ago. Another big surprise, since until then, Liefer didn't think she wanted to have a child. Her memoir also is about comedy and how her father helped inspire her to become a comic. Terry spoke with Carol Liefer last year.
Carol Liefer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Your opening essay in the new book is about your father, who recently died at the age of 86. And you write that he's the reason you wanted to be funny, because he was funny. And in this piece, you tell one of the jokes that he used to tell. It's a, quote, dirty joke that you didn't get when you were a kid. It is such a great joke, so I have to start by asking you to tell it.
Okay. Well, a guy goes to the movies with his pet chicken. And he buys two tickets, and the person says, who's going in with you? And he goes, well, my pet chicken here. And the ticket person says, hey, you can't bring an animal in the movie theater. So the guy goes around the corner. He stuffs the chicken down his pants, goes into the movies, and the movie starts, but the chicken is starting to get a little hot. So the guy unzips his fly to let the chicken stick his head out and get a little air. So a little bit of time has passed by, and a woman nudges her friend and says, you know, this guy next to me just unzipped his pants. And the woman goes, ah, look, you know, you've seen one, you've seen them all. And the woman goes, yeah, I know, but this one's eating my popcorn.
I love that.
Yes, hilarity ensues. But I remember as a kid, you know, my father telling this joke a lot and getting big laughs. And I was young enough that I didn't really understand it, you know, because all I heard was a chicken and a, you know, a zipper, and it didn't really make sense. I found out, you know, what the joke meant later, and that just might have been the thing that pushed me into lesbianism, but
which we'll get to later.
Yeah, but I really, you know, my father was the king of the joke tellers, and I was so impressed as a child watching him hold people in rapt attention with these stories, and it had a big impact on me.
So did he actually collect jokes?
He did. My father, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he'd always say, throw at any subject and I got a joke on it. And he really, one of the high points of his life was my mom is a PhD in psychology, and she went to one of her psychology conventions, and the scheduled entertainment for that night had canceled. And the psychologist, knowing that my father was a big joke teller, asked if he would mind stepping in and telling some jokes. And as I hear it, you know, he was thrilled and delighted. And he, I think, told about a half an hour or 45 minutes of jokes, and he killed. And it was really a fantastic night for him.
Now, the essay that was the biggest surprise to me in your book is the one in which you explain that although you'd been married, although you'd always liked boys, you wanted to have a lesbian fling. And the woman you had that fling with more than 12 years ago has become your partner. You've since adopted a son. You have 7 rescue dogs together. So let's start at the beginning of this story.
Okay.
Why, after what being sounds like an enthusiastic heterosexual, did you decide that you wanted to try being with a woman?
I don't know what came over me, Terry. It just became this obsession. I just remember I really wanted to have an affair with a woman. I remember this movie Bound was out at the time.
Oh, Gina Gershon? Is that the... Gina?
Yes, yeah. Yes. But I remember there were these sex scenes in Bound, and I must have burned through the videotape. I just watched it so much. It just became something I had to do. And, you know, little did I know that this woman that I would meet at a charity event, at a Project Angel Food event, would, you know, be the woman who I had this fling with, who I didn't expect. I fell madly in love with, and here we are 12 years later.
When you realized that you were actually serious about her and her about you, and this was going to be a long-lasting relationship, did you have to, like, reorient parts of your identity? Because now you were in a lesbian relationship, in a long-term one. You know, so it wasn't about, like, having your lesbian fling. It was the real thing.
No. Mm-mm. No. It was difficult because I did approach this as, oh, you know, my fun, chic lesbian affair. This will be a great story. And I didn't expect to be captivated and to find myself really so in love in such a different way. And it was a difficult transition because, you know, it was like, this is supposed to be my fun fling. This was not supposed to be something to redefine me. It's a vast transformation. I mean, I have a joke about it in my book that, you know, I went to gay bookstores for help. You know, yes, excuse me, do you have what the f*** just happened to me? because it is that powerful of transformation in your life.
So, and what does it say? Mm-hmm. What does it say? Do you think that you changed? That do you think you had like repressed feelings about girls when you were younger? Do you think that you were heterosexual at one time and that just changed? Do you think that it means you're bisexual, or that there's this kind of like shifting scale of sexuality and your scale shifted? I mean, do you think of sexuality, the nature of sexual orientation, differently than you did before?
I do. I think that what I've learned from the experience is that our sexuality is constantly evolving and can be a fluid thing.
Or at least for some people it can. I think for some people it probably can't be. On both ends.
I mean, yes. But I do think that it really did hit me like a bolt of lightning. And I'm not an unexamined person. I mean, I've been in therapy most of my adult life, you know. But I'm not sure. I mean, I do talk in the book about, you know, my first crush was on Davy Jones of the Monkees, you know. And I had a lot of powerful feelings for boys. But I remember as a kid being obsessed with Herb Alpert had this album cover. And it was a woman who was naked, who was covered with whipped cream. And I was really fascinated with it. And it's like, I don't know, was that some early indication of some attraction to women? I'm not sure, you know.
So how do you tell your parents when you're in your late 30s, you've been married, that you're actually now a lesbian?
Well, it was an interesting ride. You know, it had started a little bit earlier because really, I think 3 weeks after I met Lori, I had a breast cancer scare. And I went and had a mammogram. And it was the worst thing that, you know, a woman expects when you go to have a mammogram, where, you know, usually you're kind of in and out. And it was one of these, oh, stick around. The doctor wants to take more films, and then comes back again and take more films. And, you know, I basically left this radiologist's office that day with, you know, I cornered him as I was leaving. Like, well, what do you think it is? And he was like, I think it's 80-20 probably cancer. And I was like, what are you basing that on? He was like, from 20 years of doing what I do. And, you know, I immediately called Lori. We'd only been together for 3 weeks, you know, even to the point where I wouldn't even have referred to her as my girlfriend yet, but something in my adrenaline made me reach out to her. And she was so rock solid to me in that moment. And I think about it a lot because it had such an impact on me and our relationship. It was like, you know, breathe and let's get through this and don't worry about it. And, you know, I really had a day, 24 hours, where I thought I had cancer. And she was amazing. I mean, she came over to my apartment and brought a big basket of movies and thought we'd relax and hang out and kind of chill. But I was like, I need to get drunk. I just want to get drunk. And, you know, she took me to this great place that we like. She let me get drunk. She drove me home. And it turned out, you know, the next day I spoke to the doctor and it was a fibroadenoma, which is a non-cancerous tumor. But I had to go. I went back to New York to have this fibroadenoma out. And Lori came with me, and we went and visited my parents on Long Island just to say hello before my procedure. So, you know, I was not ready to come out to my parents yet. This was still very new. So Lori came as my, quote, friend. Anyway, we saw my parents, and I had the procedure. About 6 months later, I called my folks up because I wanted to come to New York and tell them about meeting Lori and being gay now. And you know, to Jewish parents. I mean, I called. I said, I want to come back to Long Island and talk to you about something. You know, the first thing my mother said was like, you're not sick, are you? It's like, no, I'm not sick. You promise you're not sick? No, I'm not sick. And I went back to talk to my parents about it. And I completely expected them to be very emotional about it and basket cases. And the kind of the flip thing happened. I was the basket case. I was so emotional. My parents were cool as cucumbers about it. And I was crying, actually. And, you know, my father, my dear, sweet father, was like, why are you crying? And I said, well, you know, I thought you would be disappointed. And my father said, disappointed? I'll tell you when I was disappointed. When you married that Shagetz, you know, which is Yiddish for a non-Jewish person. So they were amazing about it. But what I think was also very revealing was when I came home to come up to my parents, my mother did say to me, I knew when Lori came with you to come back for that procedure for the fibroadenoma that you were lovers. And she knew, she said, because we took a walk around the neighborhood that day and we walked ahead of my parents. And my mother said, I could tell the way you two were walking together that you were a couple. And I think that's so interesting. I mean, look, she is also a shrink. She might be a little more highly attuned to people and you know, their behavior. But it's just interesting what you think you can hide that you can hide.
So you must have been really grateful to your parents for getting it. And not,
I was.
Not for, you know, being upset or worrying, like, how are we going to tell our friends? Or, you know, like, don't bring her home.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I do think, though, that to me, like, the power of Judaism, it's like, you know, the fact that my parents met Lori, liked her, but, you know, the fact that she was Jewish, it was like, you know, she could have been a chimp. It's like, hey, she's Jewish. You know, it's like, add 1,000 points. They were just so thrilled and delighted, you know. The trade-off of a guy who's not Jewish to a woman who's Jewish, they were like, you know, hey, let's break out the Manischewitz, you know.
Carol Leifer speaking with Terry Gross in 2009. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with comedian and author Carol Leifer. Her memoir, When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win, has just come out in paperback.
You never wanted to have children, and you had been married. I mean, you could have had children then. But when you were 50 and your partner, Lori, was 43, you both decided to adopt. What changed your mind about having children?
It's just still so interesting to me. I really, really thought not only, you know, I couldn't have children at that point, but I just never really wanted to have kids. And then it became more of a passion for Lori, and we started to talk about it. And then it just suddenly became something that we really wanted to do. And I, you know, that's what I love about you know, adoption. It there's no age limit to it. And so at 50 and 43, we adopted our son Bruno, and it's really been amazing. It's been something that I never would have expected to be as great as it is. And what I love about it is that I think I'm so much of a better mother now at 52 than, oh God, I would have been at 42 or 32.
Why?
I just think it's, I just have a different pace to my life now than I did then. It was much more go-go, you know, turning on all cylinders. It's much easier for me to kick back now. And I think what really makes a great parent, especially now that I am a parent, is the ability to kick back and be with it and enjoy it, because I think it's all, that's what a kid is all about. And, you know, what I think is so fascinating is all the platitudes that I'd heard about kids somehow start becoming real, you know. I'd always heard you kind of re-experience the world through your child's eyes. And it seemed kind of, you know, dumb and fake to me. And it really happens.
Let's get back to telling jokes.
Okay.
You at the beginning of our interview, you were talking about your father and how he was a great joke teller and how you got started when you were still in college. Working as a comic, do you now feel like there's a part of you that's attached to an older period of showbiz, one that doesn't exist anymore?
Hmm.
I'm thinking, for instance, that I know in your collection of prized possessions, you have some cue cards that a patter between Milton Berle and Bob Hope from a special that you worked on. You opened for Sinatra in Vegas.
Yeah.
You were on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Now, granted, this was late in Sinatra's life. It was late in Carson's career. But still, you were there for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's also one of the things I love about, you know, where I'm at in my life and my career. You know, I've been doing what I do for, it's going to be 32 years. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me, you know, that I've been doing what I love for so long. And the advantage of being, you know, having been around for so long is that I have, you know, been with the greats like Sinatra and, you know, being on a Bob Hope special with Milton Berle. And, you know, I'm very happy that I'm a little bit of a yenta that way, you know, waiting around after a special like that. Like, would you mind very much if I took the cue cards, you know? that kind of stuff, and making sure that I got a picture with Carson when I was on with him. Because there is this bond that you have of this quirky little skill you have that does make you this part of this fraternity.
One more thing. Growing up with a mother who is a psychologist, you know, a lot of kids feel like their mothers are kind of omniscient and can read their minds and they can't get away with stuff. Did you feel that way about your mother, especially since she was a psychologist?
Well, I used to do a line about my mom and my act, Terry, that she was not crazy about, which was, it's hard to picture my mom solving other people's problems when she's the root of most of mine. Yeah, she did not dig that joke. But, you know, having a shrink for a mom is it's different. It's weird. And in certain ways, I think they forget to take their shrink hat off and just put the mom hat on. I think that's kind of always the challenge, you know. But I remember another funny story. When I was learning to drive, I went driving with my mom, and I accidentally hit the squirrel in the road. And my mother, to cheer me up, was like, you know, don't worry, the squirrel clearly displayed suicidal tendencies anyway, so don't bum out about it.
Well, Carol Leifer, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Carol Leifer speaking with Terry Gross in 2009. Her memoir, When You Lie About Your Age, the Terrorists Win, has just come out in paperback. She'll be one of the writers on this year's Academy Awards. The African guitarist, singer, and bandleader known as Franco was that continent's first modern international pop music superstar. He sustained a busy career from when he was 18 in 1956 until his death in 1989 at age 51. Yet he remains little known in America. He never found a U.S. record label to support him, and he did only two brief tours here in the mid-'80s. Music critic Milo Miles explains how two recent Franco collections, the best ever made, finally could establish him in this country.
Now that Nigerian Afrobeat originator Fela Kuti has a hit Broadway play devoted to him, it's safe to say he's finally edged into the pop culture pantheon, a dozen years after his death. It's an open question whether an even bigger star in Africa, who's been dead even longer, the Congo soukous master Franco, will ever get the same acclaim. He deserves it, but he doesn't translate as well, and not only because he never sang in English. Even so, two recent collections, Francophonic Volume 1 and Volume 2, make a powerful case through music and performance alone that Franco was an irresistible force, the sorcerer of the guitar, as he was called. When Franco started out in the 50s, jazz was a generic term in the Congo for modern music, and his band was called OK Jazz. They could be wonderfully sweet even when loudly boasting, as in this early hit that describes their effect on audiences. Translated, it says, "You come in okay, you leave KO." The early style of Franco and other groundbreaking bandleaders like Grand Kale was called Congolese rumba, but that was about as exact a term as jazz. The music mixed several Latin styles and several indigenous folk modes, all the blends being very easy to dance to, though not as familiar to American ears as, say, Fela's funk and soul influences. One of Franco's strengths was that even after he became a wealthy star, he kept the sound of OK Jazz stripped down and propulsive. No string sections, no heavy electronics. During the 70s and 80s, he downplayed the standard horn section and underscored the interplay of three electric guitars in a jamming section called the Seben. These hot licks workouts became so popular the music was given a new name, soukous, and Franco was without question the grand master. With help from Ken Brown's liner notes, it's easy to make out Franco's social role as a popular musician. Like the honky-tonk country performers and the first electric blues players in America, Franco celebrated, exhorted, and comforted a vast audience that was moving from the traditions of rural life to the harsh jumble of urban striving. The Congo and much of Africa was throwing off colonialism and trying to get a grip on the modern marketplace at the same time. How not to foolishly waste your cash was a regular Franco theme, but so was how to spend it. Here's the catchiest Volkswagen commercial you'll ever hear, Asda.
toko kiko somba vewe na azda 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 kombo ya sika bazai wa mapesi kombo ya difko ekunda milelo toponi azda toko kiko loba toko kiko yemba toko kiko somba vewe na azda 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 kombo ya sika bazai wa mapesi kombo ya difko ekunda milelo toponi azda.
The Francophonic collections feature the most vibrant, full sound of any Franco releases, particularly on the vintage sides. Volume 2 is a recommended introduction. All of the Francophonic cuts present sweet choruses, tart horn sections, and the great sorcerer's guitar swirling through everything, presenting Franco as he always wanted to be, larger than life, stronger than death.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Francophonic, Volumes 1 and 2.